It depressed Emma how preoccupied her new circle was with her old one. It seemed half the conversation was about the posse. In a transparent attempt to mask their sense of inferiority, they spoke of Charlotte and company in strictly hostile terms. Even more pathetic was that their actual interactions with members of the clique were shamelessly obsequious. Charlotte was quick to replace Emma with Leslie as her best friend, and sat next to her when the class didn't have assigned seating. One day, Leslie emerged from the bathroom with the back of her skirt tucked into the waist of her underpants. It was recess, and Emma was one of about a dozen witnesses who'd been sitting in the locker cove, the only one who hadn't leapt up and chased her down the hall in a frantic scramble to heroically alert her before she could embarrass herself. Emma watched Leslie wave them off with a smile and continue on her exposed pink butt cheek way. "She knows. She tucked it in on purpose. It's for a dare," so explained the Committee of Concerned Citizens upon returning to the locker cove.
"They all have to do something," someone testified. "Everyone in the clique wrote a dare on a piece of paper, and whoever picked that slip has to do it."
"Charlotte has to leave a condominium on Monsieur Durant's desk," another added in a whisper. This elicited a chorus of laughter.
"A condom! A condom!" everyone corrected her.
That was the day Emma decided to disassociate herself from everyone in the whole grade. What did it matter if she didn't have friends? To do good things, to be a good person, this was what counted. A new high-rise was going up one block north of them. A self-proclaimed luxury building. It was called the Parkview. The name was ironic, as once upon a time, Laura had been able to look out her bedroom window and see a band of green that was the tops of the trees in Central Park. Now, this ugly tower blocked the view. It was so upsetting that she began thinking of it as a temporary thing. One morning she'd wake up, and it would be gone, view restored. But no, not only was it here to stay, it was growing taller by the day. But then something remarkable happened that affirmed Laura's more optimistic feelings about the universe. A local anti-high-rise activist had been keeping tabs on the building's skyward trajectory, and according to his count, its height exceeded the legal zoning limit by 12 stories. The authorities were notified, and justice was served. The building's contractors were forced to take down the additional floors. The New York Times wrote an article about it, which Laura cut out and put on the fridge. "After their cityscape has crept ever closer to the clouds over the decades," it began, "Manhattanites are about to witness something decidedly uncommon, a shrinking skyscraper." A few weeks into Emma's new life, a condom was left with an anonymous note on the desk of a controversial middle school French teacher, and Emma was among those Miss Gardner summoned to her office for an interrogation. To avoid speaking the word, Miss Gardner referred to it as an object used for adult purposes, and seeing this wasn't ringing any bells for Emma, had no choice but to show her the item, which she procured from a drawer in her desk and daintily held up in a Ziploc bag.
"The nature of the note left us very concerned," Miss Gardner said, quickly slipping the contraband back into the drawer. "We are in the process of trying to determine who might have left it. Anything you know will remain confidential."
It was then that Emma realized she'd been singled out not as a suspect, but as a tattletale.
"I would guess the sixth graders," Emma offered.
"It appeared the week they were away at Frost Valley," Miss Gardner said. "If you hear anything, I would appreciate it if you passed it along to me."
Miss Gardner held Emma's gaze for a few seconds, then nodded to indicate she was dismissed. After Emma stepped out of the office, Leslie jumped out from around the corner.
"What did she want to talk to you about?" she demanded.
"Cunt." The word slipped out like a fart. Emma glanced down the hall, terrified a teacher might have heard.
"What did you just say?" Leslie asked.
"I can't talk about it," Emma said, and walked briskly away.
Trip snores.
Margaret said out of the blue. Loudly. Laura nodded sympathetically. They were at Sarah Beth's. It was Margaret's birthday, and Laura was taking her out for lunch. This used to be a biannual tradition, treating each other to lunch on their birthdays. The ritual slowed down when the girls had arrived. Now, neither of them could remember the last time they'd done it. The waiter approached to take their orders. "We're going to need a few," Margaret told him. Turning back to Laura, she said, "Anywho, it was really bad last night, which is why I look 80 years old today." "I think you look great," Laura said, though it was true she looked tired. "Have you tried earplugs?" "I've tried it all," Margaret said dismally. "Earplugs, Valium, pillow over his face. Doesn't work."
"I've been sleeping very poorly lately, too," Laura told her.
"I was always a great sleeper," Margaret shook her head wistfully, until Tripp gained 30 pounds and started snoring. Margaret lowered her voice to add, "My shrink says that's the likely cause."
"You have a shrink?" Laura asked.
"I've joined the club," Margaret said. "Sometimes I'll roll over and look at him laying there all slack-jawed." Margaret did an impression. "Snoring, drooling, snoring, his side of the blanket rising and falling. And I'll think to myself, it's a good thing I'm not one of those people who sleeps with a gun in my bedside drawer." Laura laughed. "Because if I had a gun," Margaret continued, unsmiling, "I would shoot him." Laura tried to think of a more cheerful topic. "I would shoot him," Margaret repeated.
"You remember what my mother used to say about marriage," Laura said.
"Yes," Margaret's scowl softened. "But tell me again."
"She'd say, it doesn't matter who you marry, one day you'll be sitting across a table from him thinking anything would be better than this." Margaret smiled.
"I miss your mother," she said.
"We should figure out what we're ordering," Laura said, putting on her newly acquired reading glasses so she could see the menu. In the hard-boiled light of the day, it never seemed urgent, where and when and how to dispose of them in a ceremonious manner. But in the middle of the night, it struck Laura as unacceptable. It had been almost 4 years, and her mother's ashes were still sitting on top of the bedroom bookshelf where she'd put them after her trip to Central Park, when she'd hallucinated Woody Allen. They weren't even in a proper urn, but in the tin container they'd been delivered in, like a box of cookies from some houseguest, relegated to the back of the kitchen cupboard, only discovered when it's time to move, at which point they get discarded. The Winthrop faculty attributed Emma's sudden status as a social pariah to her dramatic transformation as a student. Overnight, it seemed, Emma went from being easily distracted, disorganized, frequently unprepared, and clearly not the slightest bit concerned with her academic performance, to being extremely focused, meticulously organized, punctual, thorough, and highly invested in her grades. In classes without assigned seating, she chose to sit in the middle of the front row, where she became a regular and enthusiastic participant in class discussions. There was no more silliness in music class, giggle fits during prayers, or subversive behavior of any kind. In all her endeavors throughout the day, she conducted herself with unwavering poise, self-respect, and deference for authority. Even her handwriting was different. Once, swollen and sloppy and frequently spilling beyond the margins of the lines in her loose-leaf notebooks, now it was small, neat, and contained, as though it had suddenly become aware of itself and was eager to make a good impression. Miss Gardner called Laura in to relay all this and commend Emma for becoming a model of the Winthrop way. Laura found herself distracted by the presence of Mrs. Jones, the school social worker. Miss Gardner began by conveying how impressed she was with Emma's newfound maturity and priorities. Then, she shifted her gaze to Mrs. Jones, who asked Laura if she had noticed any changes in Emma's behavior at home. Yes, she had. Each night before bed, Emma laid out her outfit for the next day on the armchair in the corner of her bedroom, kilt, turtleneck, socks, and shoes. Then she wrote a little to-do list for the next morning. Make bed, brush teeth, check forecast. Her once messy bedroom was now immaculate, and she'd begun chiding Laura for her habit of allowing miscellaneous clutter to accumulate on the front hall table. She no longer had to be pestered to do her homework. She completed this first thing upon arriving home. Once finished, rather than turning on the TV, she took out a book. She'd gotten very into reading, in particular books about children with fatal illnesses. There was a section devoted to such books in the local Barnes & Noble. Right now, she was reading Ryan White, My Own Story, the autobiography of a boy who contracted HIV through a blood transfusion. For Christmas, she wanted to adopt a starving child from Ethiopia. "Oh my," Miss Gardner said in response to this detail. "Not literally," Laura explained. "Just sponsor."
"Adolescence is a difficult time for girls," Mrs. Jones spoke up.
"We are a little concerned," Miss Gardner said, "that Emma may feel alienated from her classmates."
"The phone doesn't ring for her anymore," Laura reflected. "There are fewer playdates and invitations to birthday parties."
Laura wished she hadn't said this out loud. She resented the portrait Miss Gardner was painting. It spoke to Emma's integrity and character that she had chosen to set herself apart from her spoiled cliquish cohorts to the detriment of her popularity. To be socially successful at Winthrop was at odds with her and Emma's values. Laura couldn't say this to Miss Gardner, of course, and the meeting concluded on an unresolved note. Laura was encouraged when, a few weeks later, Emma announced she would be joining the middle school track team. Though she'd never been particularly athletic or drawn to physical activity, Emma's interest in running quickly blossomed into a passion. Runner's World magazine began arriving in the mail. In addition to attending afternoon practice, Emma started setting her alarm an hour early to run up and down the stairs in their building. Concerned with the nutritional value of their meals, she refused to eat certain things, including butter, to which she had developed a sudden aversion.
"When you were a baby, it was your favorite food," Laura told her. "It was one of your first words. You called it cheese."
"You let me eat pure butter?" Emma asked, horrified.
One issue of Runner's World featured an advertisement for running camp. Laura found the concept of a 4-week sleepaway camp whose sole activity was jogging utterly bizarre, but Emma really wanted to go, and perhaps it would be an opportunity to make new friends. As a little girl, Emma's blonde locks had received much attention, from relatives and acquaintances to strangers in elevators and supermarkets. Afterward, she would often ask Laura to repeat the compliment. It reminded Laura of how Bibbs, when praised for something, would frequently respond, "And what do you like about it?" Her mother's ego had been like a hole that got bigger as you filled it. Laura's instinct had always been not to comment on Emma's physical appearance unless her opinion was solicited. But when she arrived to pick Emma up from running camp, it was hard not to say something. She didn't look good. Her eyes were too big, the contour of her jaw too sharp. When she turned to pick up her suitcase, the wings of her shoulder blades emerged from her back like a piece of mechanical machinery. Her legs, while slimmer, still lacked definition, but everything else was jarringly pronounced. Laura thought of how she'd used to marvel at having given birth to this plump, excitable, self-possessed little girl who subscribed to her own romantic notions of how the world worked. Whatever it was that had fueled her unruly ways, her tempestuous appetites for life, it was as if someone had inserted a straw into her veins and sucked it out. In the past, whenever Emma had been sick, Laura's heart had percolated with a love so fierce it had hurt. It disturbed her that she was unable to access such maternal feelings now. It was so noticeable, so upsetting, that Laura thought she should call Stephanie ahead of time and let her know that she would be shocked to see Emma. And she was, but not in the way Laura had expected. When they arrived for dinner at Nicholas's apartment, upon opening the front door, Stephanie gasped.
"It's skinny mini Emma," she trilled, throwing her arms around her bony shoulders. "You look beautiful." Laura had never managed to develop a rapport with Dr. Marks, Emma's new pediatrician, the way she had with Dr. Brown. This was fine. Laura had no interest in a friendship with this woman, whose reputation as one of the city's top pediatricians was clearly not earned for her bedside manner. Dr. Marks' lovely South African accent did little to mitigate her strictly business, clinically brusque demeanor. It was known that Dr. Marks had no patience for neurotic parents, which her practice was full of, and so, eager to establish herself as an exception, Laura made a conscious effort not to bring Emma in too often, or ask too many questions. Her restraint had earned her credibility, which meant that when she called the office asking if she could speak to the doctor before Emma's annual back-to-school physical, Dr. Marks returned her call right away. Laura explained that her concern about Emma's weight loss was exacerbated by the positive reception it received from others. In addition to Stephanie, several acquaintances they'd bumped into on the street also commented on Emma's appearance in the affirmative. "I've been holding my tongue. These days anything I say is the wrong thing," Laura said. "But if you could say something to her." The days of accompanying Emma into the exam room were over. After her examination, Laura was called in to speak with the doctor privately.
"Her BMI is in the 37th percentile," Dr. Marks said. "It's on the leaner side, but still within the normal range." "But she used to be on the rounder side," Laura pointed out. "It just feels like out of the blue she stopped being interested in dessert and started jogging. When we go to Jackson Hole, she never orders her favorite things. Onion rings, milkshakes, grilled cheese. She gets the French onion soup, minus the cheese on top." "It's normal for adolescents to slim down as they get older and make healthier decisions," Dr. Mark said. "I wouldn't worry about it." "Why did she want to talk to you?" Emma asked as they walked home.
"She just wanted to go over your booster shots," Laura said.
"But I didn't get any shots."
"Right," said Laura. "She was explaining why you didn't need any." On their way back, Laura bought a box of Entenmann's chocolate donuts, which Emma used to beg her to buy. Emma ate a few bites of one for dessert and threw the rest away. Yesterday's science lab had involved looking at plant cells, onion, under a microscope. Today's sample would be animal, human. The cells would come from their mouths. That's what the toothpicks were for. Emma opened her mouth and scraped the toothpick along the inside of her cheek, but when she pulled it out, nothing was on it. Applying more pressure, she tried a second time, and again, no luck. She began poking and prodding, and eventually punctured the surface of the skin. A little nodule came loose. Since it was too small to spear and tear, she bit and spat. Voila! There it was in the cradle of her palm, raw and pink and glistening, the size of a frozen pea. A moment ago it had been a part of her body. Now it was a separate thing. Emma's tongue probed the spot where it had been. There must have been a little bit of blood because her mouth tasted like a dime.
"What's that?" Mrs. Mullen asked, frowning at Emma's sample.
Mrs. Mullen's ingratiating floral perfume did not match her disgusted and irritated countenance. It took Emma a moment to realize her error. What she held in her hand was much too big. Cells were so small they were invisible. That's what the microscope was for. Duh. Mrs. Mullen continued to hover, waiting for an answer, her eyelids coming halfway down so that all you saw were the whites of her eyes, something that happened when she lost her patience or had to explain something twice.
"That's my cells," Emma told her.
"Those are your what?"
"My cells," Emma repeated, a drop of bloody drool landing on her lab report.
"From my cheek?"
"That's a lot more cells than necessary," Mrs. Mullen said with a look of repugnance.
Emma's anxiety was laced with shame. She would be more careful moving forward. As Laura often said, less is more. When Emma woke up the next morning, her tongue explored the perforation, and it was just as prominent as it had been the night before.
The cells would not grow back. The landscape of Emma's mouth was permanently altered. For the rest of her life it would be there, this little crater, and when she was at a loss for words, it was where her tongue would go. People who knew her well would come to notice it. "You're making that face," they'd say. "You're hiding something." All homework, no playdates. Emma's funk continued in seventh grade. Beneath the melancholy was an anger, but apparently it only came out at home. According to her teachers, she was a pleasure to have in class. Her language arts teacher, an uppity young thing who was a new addition to the faculty, was particularly impressed. During their parent-teacher meeting, she showed Laura a copy of a story Emma had written. Precociously titled, "A Tree Grows on the Upper East Side," it depicted the life of an emotionally neglected only child, whose high-powered, aggressive businesswoman mother didn't have a maternal bone in her body. In one scene, the daughter tried to hug her mother, who coldly rejected her. "Oh, please, I'm your mother, not your lover." "But I never said that," Laura told the teacher. "Of course you didn't," she said with a laugh. "This is fiction. We won't be studying memoir until the spring." "How wonderful to have such a creative daughter," she added when Laura didn't respond. Emma was clearly unhappy. There was no doubt about that. Laura thought it would be nice for her to have someone to talk to, an adult who wasn't a teacher or her mother. Those were her exact words, and they were the wrong ones. Emma flew into a rage. "Basically, you're saying you don't want to listen to me, so you'll pay someone else to do it?" Laura tried to defend and explain herself, but it only made it worse, and that was the end of that conversation. It was ironic when Laura thought about it. No sooner had Emma started walking than people began telling Laura what she was in for. "Good luck with that one. You think she's a handful now? Just wait till she's a teenager." Now here she was, and from an outsider's perspective, an exception to the trend, the rare docile adolescent, respectful and polite, pleasant to be around. "She's like that cliche about March," Margaret observed. "Started out like a lion, is now a lamb." Laura bit her tongue. Often she would propose doing something such as a picnic in the park, and Emma would affect an enthusiastic smile. "I have a better idea," she'd reply, briefly raising Laura's hopes before the sarcastic kicker. "Let's not, and say we did." Emma would ridicule things Laura said by repeating them in a high-pitched English accent. She grew increasingly intolerant of certain habits Laura had, singing to herself in the kitchen, saying okey-doke upon concluding a task, clearing her throat. "You don't do that at work, do you?" she'd ask. Then there was the outrageous accusation that Laura, who, when communicating with immigrants, made an effort to speak slowly, enunciate clearly, and use simple direct language, was mocking these people, insulting their intelligence and dignity. "How would you feel if someone spoke to you like this?" Laura was racist, too, of course. Only a racist would lock her doors when approaching a red light at 125th Street in Harlem. In restaurants, when Laura ordered a Coca-Cola Classic, you had to say classic, otherwise waiters assumed diet, given that's what everyone ordered these days, Emma covered her face in her hands. "It's normal to find your mother irritating," Laura told her. "Yeah, well, newsflash, Mom. I'm not the only one who finds you irritating," was Emma's cruelly cryptic response. It was tradition that the seventh graders put on a Christmas talent show. Laura remembered it from her days. She had worn white gloves and played the C and D bells in a handbell performance of "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." In addition to the younger grades, parents were invited to be part of the audience. To Laura's surprise, both of her parents had shown up. Each time it was Laura's turn to ring a note, Bibbs had giggled. All the seventh graders were expected to be part of the production, though this year, one had declined to appear on stage, electing instead to be the solitary technical crew member. Dressed in black, Emma stood on the balcony behind the spotlight, shining it on whoever's moment it was. Life hadn't required Laura to navigate unknown territory on her own, and the few occasions over the years where she had taken the initiative to do so had all been very empowering. Associated value, for instance. To think of all the money she'd saved shopping there. She took a similar pride in discovering the School for the Ethical Individual, a progressive boarding school in Vermont that no one she knew had ever heard of. Unable to sleep, she'd been reading The New Yorker in bed, and bored by the article about O.J. Simpson's upcoming trial, her eyes drifted first to a cartoon of a fox being interviewed for an office job by a goose, then to the margins of the page, where a column of boxes advertised the usual assortment of eclectic frivolities, sailing vacations, commemorative plates, specialty hats. At the bottom of the page was a small ad she'd nearly overlooked, with the words, "Instead of answers, school should teach students how to ask questions." Laura was intrigued, and the next morning she called the School for the Ethical Individual and requested a brochure. It arrived a week later. "What's this?" Emma asked, picking through the mail after school. "It's a school in Vermont," Laura said. "I thought it sounded like something you might be interested in." "A boarding school?" "Not the usual kind," Laura said. Emma looked dumbfounded. "You want me to go to a boarding school?" "Of course not," Laura answered. "The idea of you leaving makes me very sad. I just happened across an ad for it in The New Yorker, and it sounded like the sort of place, I don't know, you're only in seventh grade, but I was thinking, down the road, you might want to explore other options for high school." Emma took the brochure into her bedroom. After 2 hours, she found Laura in the living room. "They have an eighth grade class," she announced. "I could start next year." "Eighth grade?" Laura repeated. "Are you sure? That seems much too young." Emma nodded and pointed to a page in the brochure. "The deadline to apply is next Monday," she said.
4 days from now?"
11 days, Emma said. "Not this Monday, the next Monday." "Well, unfortunately, that's much too soon," Laura said. "These things take time. We'd have to ask them to mail us an actual application, then there are forms you fill out, then we'd have to let Winthrop know, then I imagine there's an essay you'd have to write."
"I know," Emma said. "I started writing it."
"What?"
"I already called the office to ask for an application, and the woman on the phone told me the essay question."
"She was really nice," Emma added softly. She twirled a strand of hair around her finger. "The essay's really easy. Just, why do I want to go there?"
That weekend, they drove up for a tour and spent the night in the school's guest cottage, which was tucked between its admissions office and its chicken coop. In addition to chickens, the campus was home to llamas, sheep, ducks, and goats, which students were responsible for caring for. Faculty and staff went by first names and dressed in blue jeans and hiking boots. The students struck Laura as refreshingly earnest and kind, going out of their way to say hi and make Emma feel welcome. They almost didn't seem like teenagers, with their unabashed enthusiasm for their school. Laura couldn't have been more charmed and impressed on every front.
"I think you should apply for ninth grade," she told Emma as they drove home. "You'll be more emotionally prepared to go away then."
"I'm ready now," Emma said.
Laura's heart sank when Emma finally emerged from her room, clutching the letter that had arrived that afternoon, eyes glassy with tears.
"They're idiots," Laura said, shaking her head, though a small part of her was selfishly relieved.
"Fools! They'd be so lucky to have you."
"No, Mama," she said, blinking. "They want me. I got in."
In the past, Douglas had met with his children individually to go over their personal finances, but this year, he decided to bring them together for a group conversation, which also included Stephanie.
The four of them convened for a weekday lunch at Serafina.
"We're going to have to tighten the belt a bit this year," he announced after they'd been seated.
"I know, Dad," Nicholas said grimly. "We'll be canceling our membership to Lawrence Beach Club."
"Dad's been paying for that?" Laura reached for the breadbasket. "That's news to me."
"Like you don't accept the occasional handout," Nicholas said.
"For necessities, of course. Not for frivolous expenses," she said, chewing. "For example, on the way in, I handed the maitre d' a deposit for Emma's surprise going-away party." Laura paused to swallow, and to allow Douglas a chance to offer to reimburse her. When he didn't, she continued. "Not sure if you've received the invitations yet, but it'll be taking place in the private room upstairs. Anyway, boy, did that check make a dent. This is the last meal I expect to be eating out for a while, that's for sure."
No one spoke as their iced teas arrived.
"Anyway, I don't doubt your annual dues to LBC aren't extravagantly expensive, but I would have assumed your Wall Street salary would cover them," Laura said after the waitress left. "How much are you making these days anyway?"
"A lot less than 2 years ago," Nicholas answered. "Not sure if you've read the paper recently, but my sector was stagnant last year. Some people are calling it another recession."
"And whose fault is that?" Laura muttered, helping herself to a second piece of bread. This time she went with rosemary brioche. She reached for the salt and shook it onto the dish of olive oil before dipping in it.
"Not bond traders," Douglas defended his son. "It's the Fed."
"Yes, and those who work in bonds are suffering the impact," Stephanie stroked her husband's arm. "His firm took a huge hit."
"You see, Laura, the economy," Nicholas coughed into his hand and then draped his arm around Stephanie as he leaned back into the booth, "is some vague abstract thing to you that you hear about on NPR, but not all of us are so lucky. Take your annual income and imagine it was cut in half and try supporting a family of three."
"I'd be 25,000 poorer," Laura shrugged. "Not enough money to cry about. So, yes, it's sort of hard for me to relate, as I imagine in your case that figure is still well into the six digits."
"My salary is none of your business," Nicholas said. "But that's very interesting that you've been able to send Emma to Winthrop all these years on a $50,000 income, and now this socialist boarding school she's going to? That ghetto supermarket you're always gloating about must really be cheap for you to have that much left over."
"Laura doesn't pay for Emma's tuition," Douglas said. "I do, and this is why I called you all here together."
Their waitress reappeared, poised to take their orders. Douglas held up a finger, and she went away.
"You see, my father,"
Douglas paused to make sure he had everyone's attention,
"was very discreet about the degree to which he financed which children's lives. Some received more assistance than others, and this caused much suspicion and hostility among the siblings. A similar thing happened to your mother's family. I don't want that to happen to you, so I'd like to lay it all out on the table."
"Literally," he said,
opening his briefcase and pulling out four copies of a spreadsheet that he passed around the table. "Daddy pays a quarter of your mortgage?" Laura asked incredulously.
"Yup," Nicholas responded, "and 100% of yours."
"If you look at the next column, you'll see the total amount and that they're nearly the same figure," Douglas explained.
"And yours is almost paid off, too," Nicholas said, investigating the numbers more closely. "No housing expenses except maintenance. That must be nice."
Laura smiled back. "And it must be nice living on Park Avenue."
"I guess my financial advisor was right,"
Douglas chuckled.
"I was just at his office this morning, and when I told him about this lunch, he suggested I invite a family therapist along."
Seeing his comment failed to lighten the mood, Douglas cleared his throat.
"In addition to Nicholas's salary, The recession has affected the family trust, and to ensure that I can continue to help the two of you down the road, there will need to be cutbacks, he said. Nicholas, if you are prepared to sacrifice your club membership, that will do it. Your mortgage and the other expenses can stay.
You mean quarter of my mortgage? Nicholas's cheeks reddened. Vastly different from mortgage, which implies the whole thing.
Douglas nodded.
Thank you for the clarification, Nick.
Wait. Stephanie shook her head. I'm confused. Doesn't this mean that the distribution will be different amounts?
Douglas nodded. That is correct. There will be a discrepancy in the numbers, and with your blessing, it will be in Laura's favor. Given her status as the sole provider of a single-parent household, who works in the nonprofit sector, and that it's for Emma's education rather than a club membership, I think it's justified. But if you object, by all means, speak up.
No, of course, it makes sense, Stephanie said.
This isn't an objection, Nicholas said, just another clarification. But when you said we need to tighten our belts, what you really meant is my belt.
The sisterly pride Laura felt over Nicholas's progress in boldly challenging their father without a trace of a stutter was complicated by his anger toward her, and furthermore by a wistful pang for the vulnerable little brother he no longer was. He'd been an adult for years, of course. He had an important job and a wife and a child and an apartment, but for the first time, she saw him as a man. Resolute, rational, and mostly remote, any transparent feelings fenced in by barbed wire.
I apologize for using the wrong pronoun, Douglas conceded.
Nicholas wasn't done clarifying. And Laura's belt will be loosening, as I assume the tuition for the School for the Ethical Individual is more than Winthrop, given that it includes room and board, not to mention llamas.
Yes, you could call it taking one for the team, Nicholas. So what do you think? Are we all good?
Matter resolved, Nicholas declared with hostile enthusiasm. I'll call the club as soon as I get back to the office.
I appreciate this, Nicholas, Laura said, trying to make eye contact with her brother. It's very generous of you.
Well then, Douglas picked up his menu. Now that we've got that whole business out of the way, let's order.
No one felt like talking after that. A tense quiet descended upon the table. The waitress returned, took their orders, and left. Their food arrived. They began eating. Their waitress stopped by to see how everything was. Douglas, only a few bites into his steak, asked if he could take the rest to go. As his plate was removed, he smiled sheepishly.
This is a new thing I do now that your mother's gone. It would have mortified her.
I think it's a great idea, Dad, Laura said warmly.
You have to be somewhere? Nicholas asked.
No, but I have a feeling my optimism that things were resolved was premature.
Douglas took out his wallet and put $200 bills on the table.
Stephanie, I'm putting you in charge. See to it they work this thing out.
Stephanie, clearly flattered to have been designated the reasonable one, offered her father-in-law a placid smile.
Thank you for lunch, she told him.
Yes, thanks, Daddy, Laura added. Nicholas echoed the sentiment with something between a grunt and a nod.
Pay to play, Douglas said, with a jovial wink, and then he was off.
Should I drop this off at 136? Stephanie asked when the waiter returned with a doggy bag.
Don't bother, Nicholas said. Sandra's making him dinner anyway. Maybe give it to that guy who's always on the corner.
James, Laura said. His name is James.
Well, Nicholas sighed. I guess we should return those swim trunks we bought Nicky, now that he won't be needing them for his swim lessons.
He glanced at Stephanie, who looked at her plate.
The Y has a great pool, Laura offered.
Yes, I hear they also have a great rec room, a space you rent out for children's parties.
Emma's surprise party isn't a children's party, as there weren't many children to invite. Nearly all the guests will be adults, Laura said. The last few years have been very difficult and lonely for her. I want her to feel supported and loved before she heads off to Vermont.
We're sad to see her go, Stephanie said. But her new school sounds like a great fit.
Yes, Nicholas smirked. She'll learn all about radical feminism, and then she can graduate and start a llama farm.
Oh, Nick, stop teasing, Stephanie said, smiling.
No, he's right, Laura cut in. The great thing about the School for the Ethical Individual is that it encourages kids to pursue all sorts of careers, to do things that don't perpetuate the cycle of inequality that makes it impossible for people who weren't born into circumstances like ours to achieve the American dream.
Speaking of social justice, Nicholas said, I attended my first meeting as a member of the board of the library, and the new director, Karen, raised an issue of concern. Turns out there's an employee, has worked there for years, happens to be a member of the museum's founding family.
As you are, Laura interjected, which is why you're on the board.
Of course, though being a member of the board is quite different from being a salaried employee, who apparently has taken certain liberties over the years, such as adjusting the hours of her position to suit her schedule, which is perfectly understandable given her home life situation, but has struck some of her colleagues as a little unfair, as they're not granted such flexibility, nor do they enjoy an 8-week paid summer vacation. Not that they have seashore summer houses to go to. The reason this all came up...
Nick, Stephanie said. It's okay, Stephanie, Laura said. I want to hear the rest.
It was discovered that eliminating said employee's position to outsource the work to a professional wedding planning service would more than double the museum's annual profits.
Because they could do it so much better than me?
Because they could handle one wedding a weekend as opposed to two a month, plus summers.
Are you trying to tell me I'm about to lose my job?
No, to the contrary. Your job's not going anywhere, and it never will. Don't worry about that, Nicholas said with a sarcastic grin. The proposal was shot down by the trustees, who acknowledged the director's concerns about unfair advantages enjoyed by that particular employee, and said they were aware of more profitable alternatives, but that it was not within her jurisdiction to do anything about it. He folded his napkin neatly, placed it on the table, and patted it. That particular employee's job security was a priority.
Laura was admiring the cake for Emma's surprise party when she heard the front door open, and in her frenzied panic, put the cake in the freezer and slammed the door with such force that a few of the magnets slipped off, and a flurry of papers fluttered to the floor. Among these was the mysterious stick figure picture that had arrived in the mail years earlier. When it fell, it unfolded. It wasn't glued together after all, but must have gotten stuck to itself in transit. It was a handmade card, and the interior featured a shakily scrawled heart containing Emma's initials. A post-it note read,
I thought you might want to have this sweet drawing by your daughter. Tim spoke very fondly of you. Tina Brown Fuchs.
There was a newspaper clipping tucked inside the fold. As Laura saw what it was, the sounds of traffic continued, but everything else seemed to stop. She waited until Emma had sequestered herself in her bedroom before picking up the phone. I'm looking for a number for Tina Brown Fuchs, she told the operator. I'm not sure what state, but you might start with Ohio.
Timothy Brown, M.D., 1950 to 1991.
Dr. Brown had not gotten infected with AIDS, his sister Tina told Laura over the phone, but fear of the disease had prevented any of his patients from following him to downtown pediatrics. He had similar troubles in San Francisco, where he had moved with Chris, who had gotten infected, though apparently he was still living. The two had split up, and Dr. Brown had returned to Ohio to take care of their mother, who was suffering from dementia. Following her death, he had taken his own life. Laura hadn't felt right telling Emma all the details she'd just learned, but Emma, who remembered Dr. Brown well, had coaxed them out of her.
"That's all I know, darling," she said, when Emma wanted more information. "That's all the information his sister volunteered, and I didn't want to pry."
"Do you think he had depression?" Emma asked. "Like a chemical thing in his brain?"
"I don't know," Laura said, still too stunned to feel anything. "Life is complicated. You never really know what it's like to be someone else."
The two of them sat at the kitchen table in silence. From the street below came the jingle of an ice cream truck. Soon it would be time to leave for Emma's surprise goodbye party, Laura realized.
"I thought we'd go out for dinner tonight," she told Emma. "I made us a reservation at Serafina."
"I can't even think about food right now," Emma said with a sigh.
"Me neither," Laura agreed. "But it's important to eat."
The party was in a small private room in the back of the restaurant. Seated around the table were Emma's grandfather, Charlotte and Margaret and Tripp, her mother's friends Edith and Janet, Nicholas and Stephanie and Nick Jr., Emma's second cousin Holly, and Holly's mom, Ginny. "Surprise," they said in unison as Emma entered. Her cheeks were chapped from dried tears. She was sure her eyes were still red. Her face still felt puffy and swollen, but if any of the guests noticed she'd been crying, their smiles didn't betray it.
"Thank you," Emma said, doing her best to affect excitement and gratitude.
The grief that had gripped her on the walk over abruptly subsided. A cold, quiet anger took its place as Emma realized she'd been duped. "It's important to eat." How typical of her mother to insist on carrying through with a party in the wake of what they'd just learned. Emma pulled out a chair next to Nick Jr., but Laura pointed to an empty place at the other end of the table.
"I put you over there," she said, "between Charlotte and Holly."
Emma saw that Laura had made place cards with everyone's name handwritten. She was relieved to discover that Holly and Charlotte had already seemed to strike up a rapport with each other, as she had very little to say to either of them. She and Holly didn't have much in common outside of Ashant, and Emma and Charlotte had barely been on speaking terms for over a year now.
"Were you surprised?" Holly asked as Emma sat down.
"You looked really surprised," Charlotte said.
"I was," Emma admitted.
"I had no idea. It's not the kind of thing my mom does, throw surprise parties."
"We were just talking about how cute your mom is," said Charlotte.
"We love her cowboy boots," Holly added. "So retro."
Emma reached for her water as she tried to think of something to say. Making small talk with anyone was taxing, but it was less painful with a stranger. With both Charlotte and Holly, there was the unspoken intimacy of having grown up together, in knowing each other first and foremost as children. To carry on as they were now felt like a betrayal of their most authentic, primal selves, further degrading the integrity of their childhood bond.
"I'm so happy it's finally warm out," Charlotte said.
"Me too," Holly agreed. "I'm so excited for it to be, like, hot."
Emma recalled an interesting fact she had once learned. The murder rate rises when it's hot.
"Okay," Holly responded, raising her eyebrows.
Charlotte mirrored her expression.
"That's random."
At the other end of the table, Stephanie scolded Nick Jr. for blowing bubbles into his chocolate milk.
"One more time, and I take the straw away from you," she warned him.
"Emma," Janet hollered from a few seats away. "Your new school sounds absolutely fantastic."
"Thank you," Emma responded. "Are you so excited?"
Emma mustered a smile and nodded, but Janet's face remained fixed on hers, as if she weren't convinced, and so Emma smiled harder and added,
"I'm really, really excited."
She was, though being asked to exuberantly express this, to match the caliber of Janet's enthusiasm, felt perfunctory and made the sentiment ring false. One of the more exhausting aspects of getting older was having to act like an adult. Pretending to like people you couldn't stand, speaking for the sake of filling a silence, smiling when you felt like crying.
"I can't wait to hear all about it,"
Janet grinned and turned her attention to the waiter who was taking orders. Throughout the meal, Emma found her mother pursuing eye contact with her from across the table. Once their gazes met, Laura would smile, forcing Emma to smile back. It was as though she were willing her to suppress any feelings about Dr. Brown. Just as it was important to eat, it was important to maintain composure in the company of others. Buck up. Fake it till you feel it. The show must go on. This was the way they did things, these people in the world she'd grown up in. Emma looked around the table at everyone laughing and chatting as if they didn't have a care in the world. She knew this wasn't the case, but it seemed to be the impression they strived to make. I'm great. Isn't life fabulous? How wonderful. Deep down, they all knew this was a lie, which was why it was so important that everyone make an effort to pretend everything was hunky-dory, to keep up the collective charade. Which was why individuals who refused to do this were labeled depressed or mentally ill, when really they were just honest, the brave ones who refused to be fake. She thought of her grandmother. Douglas had another party to go to and left before dessert. A polite hush fell over the table as he apologized for his early departure and then announced he had a present for Emma. He reached into the pocket of his blazer and pulled out a book.
Years ago, someone broke into the house and stole a handful of items that we eventually got back, and this was one of them. So, either the thief had good literary taste, or this is quite valuable. He held up a book. A signed first edition of Catcher in the Rye, Douglas said, prompting a chorus of oohs and, that's my favorite book, a claim that baffled Emma, who felt the book had been written specifically for her, at the expense of present company.
Thank you, Doug, Emma said.
Remember to have fun at school, kiddo, he added before taking off.
After dinner, there was a cake from the fancy bakery where her mother ordered wedding cakes. It was decorated with edible flowers, and the top was inscribed with the words, Good luck, Emma, written in icing, next to the image of a bird taking flight.
Why is there a pigeon on the cake? Asked Nick Jr.
It's a sparrow, Laura corrected. How sweet, Stephanie said. To Nick Jr., she added, It's like Emma is a bird who's flying off to a new nest. When Emma was little, she used to get overstimulated before bed, Laura explained. Sometimes the only way to get her to settle down was to let her wear herself out. So we played this game where she was a sparrow, and I'd chase her as she flew around the apartment. I'd say, I'm going to catch that little sparrow and eat her for dinner.
How fun! Edith squealed.
Laura looked across the table and smiled. It was a different kind of smile from what she'd been doing all night. A private, fragile smile, fondly wistful, gently probing. Emma nodded. Of course, she remembered. Her mother, in a rare display of silliness, pretending to be a bird catcher, dashing through the rooms, periodically pausing to catch her breath and give Emma a chance to reverse course. Emma, the sparrow, mere inches from her mother's clutch, the heart-thumping, hilarity-inducing suspense of wondering when she'd make her final swooping move, of not knowing whether you were going to escape once more, or if that was it. The School for the Ethical Individual was a 5-hour drive from Manhattan, and, as Laura had predicted, there was no traffic, and thus it had been unnecessary to set their alarms for 6 a.m. on Sunday, as Emma had insisted they do.
Mom, you're driving between the lanes.
I know, Laura said. There were no other cars on the highway, and I always wanted to see what it's like. She put on her blinker and coasted back into the right lane.
You didn't have to stop, Emma said. I was just wondering if you knew you were doing it.
I did. I was doing it on purpose.
I know. You said that already.
Do it again, Emma requested a moment later. It was sort of fun. Laura glanced in the rear view and drifted back toward the middle, then changed her mind and got back in the right. I oughtn't, she said, shaking her head.
Oughtn't, Emma repeated with disdain,
Then, in the silly English accent she adopted when ridiculing Laura, "I oughtn't break the law."
"Is oughtn't even a word?" Emma asked a minute later.
"It's a conjunction," Laura said. "Ought not."
"I know that, Mom. I mean, is a word still a word if nobody uses it anymore?"
"I don't know what you're talking about. I use it all the time."
"Well, nobody else does."
"Nor do they use most of the words in the dictionary," Laura reflected.
"Nor," Emma scoffed.
She put her seat back and rested her feet on the dashboard. Laura glanced at Emma's legs. At her most recent checkup, Dr. Marks had expressed concern that her BMI percentile had gone down from the previous year, and it would be hard to monitor her eating and exercise habits now that she would be away.
"I wish you'd just say shouldn't," Emma continued. "Every time you say oughtn't, I don't know why, but it makes me think of that Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby. It makes me sad for you."
"Eleanor Rigby?" Laura laughed. "That song is about a tragic old woman who lives in a delusional world, and a priest. I don't know what it has to do with my vocabulary choices." They passed a billboard for a personal injury lawyer named Gary. "Gary's your guy." A mile later, one for Vince. "He's invincible in court." Then for Wayne. "In pain, call Wayne."
"That wasn't very nice," Laura said.
"What wasn't?" Emma asked.
"The Eleanor Rigby comment. I don't know what you meant by it, but it wasn't a very nice thing to say."
"Sorry," Emma said. "I didn't mean it."
"I really didn't," she reiterated a moment later. "I just had that song stuck in my head for some reason."
"Thank you," Laura said. She glanced at the odometer and realized she was going well below the speed limit. "I want to apologize to you for something, too," she said, speeding up. "Something that's been weighing on me recently. Something I didn't tell the truth about." Emma retracted her feet and hugged her knees to her chest. Laura checked her mirrors, thinking she'd heard a police siren, but it was nothing.
"I didn't tell the truth about how I had you," she said.
"I didn't think it was anyone's business how I came to be pregnant, and I had no qualms giving them a different story. But you, I never felt right about it." Emma opened the window a crack. This created an air pressure situation that hurt Laura's ears. To stabilize the current, she opened her own window an inch.
"You weren't conceived with a sperm donor," she continued. "It was a one-night stand."
Laura took a deep breath. The air felt like helium in her lungs. If she didn't have her seatbelt on, she'd float up out of her seat, get sucked out the window, and slither up into the atmosphere.
"Well," Laura's eyes briefly left the road to glance over at Emma. "I imagine you have questions."
Emma was silent.
"It's not an easy conversation," Laura proceeded. "But I guess we should just get the whole thing over with. It was August. The part of the summer when everyone's out of town."
Now Emma spoke. Her voice was muffled, but it sounded like, "Stop." When Laura turned to look at her, she'd pushed her seat as far back as it would go and had draped her sweatshirt over her face. Laura's sense of gravity returned. She felt very much rooted in the car.
"Maybe now wasn't the right time to tell you."
She reached out to pat Emma's knee, but Emma brushed her fingers away.
"Please, Mom," she said, putting her seat back up. "Just take me to school. That's all I ask of you."
"Of course, darling. I'm sorry. I completely understand." She felt bad for having burdened Emma with this now, but also relieved. The information had been delivered. The conversation she'd been dreading wasn't one Emma was interested in having. The matter was over and dealt with.
20 minutes passed.
"What color hair did he have?" Emma asked.
"To be honest," Laura said after a pause, "I can't remember. I would say it was brown. I mean, it definitely wasn't red, and I don't think it was black. And I think I would remember if it was blonde. There aren't that many adult men with blonde hair out there."
"Do you want to hear the story?" Laura asked a minute later.
"No," Emma said emphatically.
10 minutes later.
"I just have a couple other questions."
You can ask me anything. Emma paused.
What did he look like?
To be honest, I don't really remember, Laura said.
Was he tall?
Yes, I think so. He must have been, since you're so much